Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores, the games every day.
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Pete, joined by Darius and Mike. And last night, we had a couple of series end that I think we all thought were kind of inevitable in their conclusion, but were interesting nonetheless. And then we have a trio of game sixes tonight, of which three road teams have the chance to close out the series. And so between last night and then what's coming up tonight, we're going to hopefully hit on all of that. D, the first place I'd like to start is the Nuggets-Warriors series. The Nuggets have been without their second and third best players, or offensive players at the very least, for the entirety of the season in Murray's case and most of the season in Porter's case. But I thought that their season at least died an honorable death last night. They fought hard. I've been so zeroed in on the attribute of strength during these playoffs that they're a team that was kind of how they made Golden State sweat a little bit, was by being bigger and more physical than them. But ultimately, their talent won out. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about Nikola Jokic, because we're probably not going to talk about him too much again for the rest of these playoffs since they're eliminated. I thought he was tremendous in that series, and I'd just love to hear your perspective of how that series ended.
Yeah, I thought Jokic played exceptional. He's an impossible player. I was trying to think of adjectives to describe him last night, and I just sort of stumbled onto impossible, because he, in a lot of ways, doesn't make sense. He is a throwback player in a lot of ways, who was given, do you remember the Back to the Future movies where what's his face, the villain dude, I forgot his name, Biff. Biff was given that sports almanac, right?
Yes.
And so he had all those results and he could bet on all of the games, and he was just like, oh, like I've got the key basically to the future right here in my hands. And that's sort of how I envision Jokic, right? He is this massive, giant human being, a classic center in so many ways, but he was almost transported back, like, and given this idea of what the modern game was going to look like, and so incorporated all of these tools into his game, where it's just like, ah, yes, I've got all of the secrets of the future right here in my game. And so he is this combination of brute strength and short area and small area agility. And he's got wonderful hand-eye coordination and great touch all the way out to the three-point line. And he reads the game so well. Like the comments that he and Draymond were sort of exchanging these basketball love letters to each other, sort of admiring each other's games. And it's because they very much are built from the same sort of piece of marble, right? Like
they're both geniuses. Yeah.
Yeah. And the way that they see the game and the way that they are consistently a step ahead of their opponents. And they're obviously not similar players, really, right? But Jokic is the type of guy who he is a classic, like, franchise tentpole. He is the guy that you can build everything around in the same way that you can, like, a LeBron James or a Giannis, right? Like, Jokic will never be the defensive player that some of these other top guys are, but he has enough ability defensively that you can say, well, because you're 7 feet tall and a massive human being, we could at least scheme for you in ways where we can leverage those strengths and you can anchor a defense that's going to be in the top half of the league. And with him being an offense unto himself, he is just one of the more potent players that I think we've seen maybe in the last 10 or 15 years and is going to go down to me as an all-time great.
The first point about Jokic is that, of course, he's incredible and he's made a massive leap from when the Lakers played him in the 1920 playoffs. And they did as well on him, and I think they had the personnel that is best equipped to do well on him as anybody has done since. And he's also gone up a level in confidence, not necessarily skill that's sort of always been there, but just in the aggressiveness to attack, I think. And that's, to me, what stood out most about his game this season, where he really realized how good he is, especially on the offensive side of the court. So in the series against the Lakers, 5 games, and you can just compare it. It's 5 games. The minutes were similar to this year against the Warriors. But, you know, as Pete alluded to, just much different size, right, from that Laker team where they started out with either JaVale McGee or eventually Dwight Howard on him. Anthony Davis spent a considerable amount of time on him. LeBron James came over to help. And then the guards that were helping down in him were Alex Caruso or Danny Green. Like, just ideal personnel to deal with somebody like that. And they held Jokic to 21.8 points on still efficient shooting, because he's going to shoot efficiently on 54% from the field. But his rebounds, 7.2, his assists, 5.0. So now fast forward to this year, and the numbers are, like, ridiculous, even in this Warriors series, which basically mirrored his numbers all season. But 31 points, 13.2 rebounds, 6 assists. Now, his turnovers were way up, 4.8 assists, and I think that goes to show you just how much he had to have the basketball on that team versus Jamal Murray had the ball, you know, for a decent amount of the series against the Lakers, and that, you know, sort of makes them a more balanced team. And so Jokic has 100% made massive gains to the point where you're going to have to find a way to deal with him if you're going to, just in the Western Conference, I think, for the next X amount of years. He clearly just didn't have close to enough help this year. And so they were never the real threat. They were one of the worst teams outside of Jokic in the postseason. My question, though, in the same sense of moving forward, is all of the defensive metrics I thought this year were ridiculous is too strong of a word, but Jokic was up there in defensive metrics. And to me, Pete, it has much more to do with sort of on off and what they had behind him and how frequently they were scoring when he was in there and therefore could set their defense and teams not specifically like. And so that I get how those made his numbers look pretty decent defensively, but we watched what the Warriors did to him still and what good teams could do to him where he is vulnerable. And if he's your five defensively and you don't really get the good rim protection and you can have him move his feet, even in a similar way that you can do to Gobert, like, that to me remains an area that I think teams are going to attack. And I'm very curious how you guys would break that down as to what Jokic's future is going to be with that defensive, which to me is still vulnerability, even if the numbers said otherwise in the regular season.
No, I think you make a fantastic argument there. And I think that Jokic being up that high in the defensive metrics is more reflective of where defensive metrics are capable of quantifying at this point. I think we're getting there for sure, but I think that there are some holes in it. And there's also a difference between regular season basketball and NBA or and playoff basketball with respect to how you game plan for unusual players. Like Darius was talking about how Jokic is impossible. I don't know if you remember, you guys remember this, but Frank Vogel mentioned during the season that Jokic is the most difficult player to game plan for. We were going to play them. I forget if it was a home game or a road game, but we had a practice on a day where we probably normally wouldn't have based on other similar circumstances during the season. And Vogel said we had this practice, and that was the practice where he made that comment. And so
Vogel, or so Jokic enjoys a certain degree of benefit from his unconventionality that when you're game plan, when you're game planning just for the Nuggets, you can attack certain things on the perimeter, and the Warriors are able to do that in ways that other teams are not. I think about, like, what do you put around Jokic, because he's so dominant that, like, Mike, that whole dynamic's always going to be there, and he's going to be attackable to some degree on the perimeter always. And so what do you put around him? We talk about, like, when we what do we put around LeBron and AD? I think that, like, an athletic defensive four is somebody that's really important for them. And Aaron Gordon fills that role, right? But they in the absence of a Michael Porter Jr. and a Jamal Murray, they just can't really carry the day on the offensive end. And so your point about how you're attacking a set defense, and when Jokic is on the floor much more frequently, it really rings true. I think that that is one of the bigger factors that go into the plus minus and on off numbers, rather than and Jokic has gotten better on defense, but I think that when you watch the games, there is some degree of, like, he can't do that. He can't, you know, stick with the small, quick guys on the perimeter. Stepped into a couple of of threes against the drop coverage where Jokic was a little bit late in closing out. That's always going to be there to some extent, D, but I think that, I mean, obviously he provides so much in so many other areas and is good enough defensively, but it is an interesting question of, like, does that put a ceiling on how far you can go when you can keep kind of targeting that, as wonderful as he is? Let's take a quick break. We come back, D, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So those are all great points, of course. My whole thing is you can never be everything.
Yes.
Like, as a single player, right? Like, maybe the greatest players ever, okay, LeBron, you can be everything. But even then, he wasn't a jump shooter, necessarily. He's more of that now, right? But there were still things that you're just like, okay, out of all of these things that we're going to try to say this is your weakest attribute, let's poke at that as much as we can. And a playoff series, almost every player in the history of the game has had something that guys would go at and target. And so I often think about, okay, well, how many teams or how many individual players are capable of taking advantage of that specific thing? And the Warriors, as much as their lack of size and maybe inability to defend around the paint outside of Draymond might have helped Jokic put up even bigger numbers, their ability to attack him in very specific ways defensively probably even things out. The one point I wanted to make about metrics is that defensive rebounding is still such a key component of almost any defensive metric, and Jokic is going to be one of the better defensive rebounders in the league. One of the reasons is because of their defensive coverages often try to keep him around the basket. And so he's in position to grab a lot of rebounds, but he's also just a good rebounder. And
great motor, great anticipation. Yeah.
The point of defense, like, you don't get a stop until you have the ball. And one of the reasons you had talked about this in the thread last night, Pete, but one of the ways that Denver was staying competitive in this last game is that they were really hunting offensive rebound chances against the Warriors and leveraging their size on their own backboards, right? And so if you can't close out a possession with a defensive rebound, then good defense for 20 seconds. Let's do it again. And let's do it again.
And you probably are going to be giving up some kick out three where somebody's wide open. So you did all that good work, but you didn't get, Lord knows we saw plenty of possessions with Lakers like that this year.
Yeah. And so just to put a capper on Jokic's defense here, I think him being an elite defensive rebounder and him just being a massive human being in the way that like Marc Gasol was, right? Where it's just like, okay, how many bunnies did the Warriors miss? But there's Jokic sort of like lurking and putting his arms up and just sort of bodying you in a way or invading your personal space. And you're just like, well, you got to make that 6-footer. Okay. Yeah, 6-footers become a lot harder when there's like a 7-foot-1 dude who's 275 pounds just sort of in your personal space, right? And so I think that contributes to his effectiveness defensively in ways too.
I also think that he's clever on top of all of that. So I think that's part of the love letters between him and Draymond is that, oh, I'm going to like turn into you a little bit, or I'm going to anticipate what you're about to do in ways that go beyond just his size and length, but he's also a step ahead mentally, which is something that is that combination of you're big and you're skilled and you're mentally a step ahead. That's a tough dude to guard.
And Mike, I'll kick this to you here because this is what I think makes AD such a special defender as well, right? When you're talking about that acumen and that ability to make reads and the instincts that you have as a defensive player, and then you have like the elite athleticism on top of that, and you have the height and the length, and, right? And then it's and. Then that's what makes AD, I think, one of the best defensive players in the world. And it's why the Lakers defense wasn't as good this year, because when that dude plays 30 something games, it's just like, no, everything is built around you. Watching Jokic and Draymond sort of control their individual spaces within the context of the playoffs really had me thinking about like LeBron and AD again, and just sort of that idea of what they can do on the court and how they also can control their personal spaces and what makes them special.
Well, let's bring AD into it, because part of what we're talking about for me is what is the optimal way to win an NBA basketball game and then series and then championship, presuming that you have some of these best players, and then what's the difference between these best players? On the one hand, in the Lakers' hand, you've got AD and LeBron. And then in Denver's case, you've got Jokic, and next year it'll be Murray as the second best player. We've gone to George and Leonard as the two. I think it's still Steph and Draymond, although that's been murky with Klay being hurt, and then he's back, and now, you know, Poole is starting to emerge offensively. But so there's these two.
It's not Wiggins, Mike? It's not Wiggins?
He is an all-star starter, Mike.
That was a tough one for me for basketball.
I remember,
for somebody that cares about basketball
right,
history.
That's right. Because you put so much stock in the awards and oh Lord.
That one hurt.
In 20 years, Mike, there's gonna be like a 25-year-old telling you that Andrew Wiggins was an all-star and it's gonna
graphic.
Piss you off.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Oh man.
Sorry.
So
sorry for the sidetrack.
It was one thing to kind of get the last all-star spot, which of course they're, you know, that wouldn't have been my choice, but to be a starter. Oh man. All right. Thank you for that sidetrack. I'm thinking about it. So Darius mentioned that there isn't a perfect basketball player other than maybe, you know, sort of peak LeBron, maybe peak Jordan, a few of these guys in their absolute peak two-way, you know, Durant, Giannis at the moment. And the way that, like, if we're assuming that you're optimizing the rest of the roster, which Denver couldn't do this year because of injuries, which the Lakers didn't do this year because of some choices, but they for the most part did when they won the title. So then what? Okay, well then you've got somewhat ideal personnel, at least that the coach can go to. Offense, defense, it works well enough. That's where, to me, LeBron and AD, that's why, like, going into that season, I was thinking, yeah, that should be the best team because they are the toughest to attack and they are the ones that can attack the best. Now, Jokic has made up a lot of ground, and we could have a whole other argument as to maybe he has surpassed LeBron as in terms of, can he get your team a great shot on every possession? I don't know that for sure. Like, for one game, I might still take, bully ball LeBron if the three ball is going. But Pete, jump in on that, because that to me is like, there is, where do we go from here with these type of groups, and how much progress has Jokic made offensively to the point where you're still going to get back to that same point that I made about the defense, where you can attack him. And I don't think you can attack LeBron and AD like in a playoff series defensively the same way.
Yeah, I think you're talking the difference between a higher ceiling with the Lakers and then a higher floor with Jokic. And the reason that I argue a higher floor is one argument you've made over the last year plus, Mike, about Jokic is like he's got a huge burden on him on that team to carry. And to do that for 82 games across, we've basically played three seasons in like 2.5 seasons worth of time. And the big factor in these playoffs, again, that is so difficult to account for is injury and attrition. And even in that last quarter, he kind of pulled his hammy a little bit. These playoffs have been real rough on a lot of good players' hamstrings. And so that ability, Mike, for him to just be available as much as he has been over these last three seasons and never let Denver fall below a certain level. You know what I mean? That's what I mean about a certain degree of floor that helped them get to a certain point where that potential playoff deficiency defensively or hole in his game in terms of his agility on the perimeter can even be a thing. So let's take another break. When we come back, we'll wrap up this conversation and then we'll talk about the games coming up tonight. So Mike, in terms of like winning a championship, I think the Lakers have a much higher chance of doing that than a Denver team built around Jokic, not just for environmental reasons at Lakers being a free agent destination and Denver being a smaller market. They've had a couple of max guys that have missed long periods of time, but also for basketball reasons, right? Jokic's presence and ability to just be there and be available raises that floor. But I think that your point about how there are some questions that the Lakers have the foundational ingredients to answer, I think that very much rings true. And that guys like LeBron and AD don't have as attackable of a deficiency in their game as Jokic's perimeter mobility is.
Yeah, man. And so it really does kind of all come back down then to that same argument of, and we could do the same thing with guards, with small guards, which we've been talking about a lot lately. Those guys have something that you can attack. And oftentimes, Darius, as you've mentioned over the years, that's what these series end up being. Hey, We know you've got this year, but you've got to have that dude on the court and we're going to exploit it. And is there something that you can exploit about us? Maybe not. And so sometimes that can be the difference. That can be the tiebreaker between these teams that are like pretty close. And I'm curious to see now. Well, first of all, we got to have this playoff run has been great. And we'll continue to cover it, but it's always in that context of how do the Lakers get back right to that point that, sure, that we all want to see.
Yeah, and I just think that when it comes right down to it, a team like Denver, the best version of them is likely going to include a defensive guy at shooting guard, right? They've been playing Will Barton there. They've gone to like Austin Rivers some there, right? And they were at their best when it was just like, hey, that's Gary Harris, like, right? And they had paid Harris like he was going to be a high level guy and his shot disappeared, right? But a real 3-and-D guy at shooting guard, and then Gordon as that defensive sort of wing guy that can be a 3 or a 4, Porter who has physical tools, and then Murray is like the lone guy. But if he's the only guy, you can account for that being only guy, especially if you're going to play in drop coverages because the asks are different. Right. And you're going to play in drops because Jokic is going to play right below the level of the ball in a lot of actions.
When you say the only guy, do you mean the only small guy amongst the group?
Yeah, like the only real attackable dude from a like physical tools, like, oh, you're not big enough to do something.
Gotcha.
Honestly, that's where the Lakers started to do things, is they were just like, okay, well, when they beat the Nuggets, it was like, well, we're going to involve you two players in screen and roll, Jokic and Murray. Hopefully we're going to get a switch of some kind, and then we're going to try to attack Murray.
Well, and Porter's attackable on defense for other reasons, not because of physical tools, but technique. He doesn't always recognize the play and all that as well.
That's right. Yeah. But he was getting better too. And I would have been very interested to see what his evolution as a defender would have looked like in this season. But a back injury that's plagued him. Let's transition, though. There's more games. The games never stop, right? Basketball just keeps on going. And so what game tonight, Pete, sticks out to you the most? Which one are you most intrigued about?
I've been consuming as much basketball as possible. I was not ready for the season to end during the regular season. And so, like, it's still playoffs for us. And so that said, the Philly-Toronto series, once Philly went up 3-0 and Embiid hit that shot, I was like, oh, this is over. And a lot of these games are like, you got the game at 4 o'clock or 4:30, and then another one starts at 5 or 5:30, and then the third game is the nighttime game. And a lot of times Philly and Toronto have been that in-between game these last two. So I've really paid close attention to that series up until game four. And then it was the, I'm gonna watch this while the other games are on halftime, because I think this one is over. But I would love to hear your thoughts, Mike, start with you on Philly and Toronto. Like, we've never had that 3-0 comeback in NBA history. I was texting the other day, if it were to ever happen, it would be some unholy combination of playoff Doc Rivers, playoff James Harden, and even playoff Joel Embiid. So I am looking with quite an amused eye, but not particularly informed on how things have gone between Philly and Toronto. So I would love to hear your thoughts on how we got here and where you think it's going.
Yeah, this has been one of the series that I have been most focused on and locked in on and really kind of enjoyed, because before the series started, I thought Toronto was going to win the series. And I think a lot of people that just watched a lot of these two teams play for the last couple of, not really months, because Philly had that initial boost once they got Harden, but they really struggled for after you got your sort of week and a half or 2 weeks of good James Harden play and behavior. And Toronto was kind of the opposite. And they were this weird team, this fast team, this explosive team. I thought they were going to be able to wear down Embiid, and we're now starting to see that. But early in the series, things got screwed up because Scottie Barnes got hurt, and just losing that one key cog, and Scottie Barnes is huge. He's, when you see him in person, he's not quite LeBron big, but he's close. Like, he's just a specimen, and having him, somebody that can do so many things out there alongside other guys that can do some of those things, like a Siakam, like an OG Anunoby, it becomes very difficult to contend with. But if you remove one of them, then there's just more places to attack. And Toronto has a pretty thin bench once you get past a couple of like the Boucher types. So he gets hurt. Fred VanVleet has been banged up for the last 2 months. And Philly's been able to kind of exploit that in certain ways. So Fred VanVleet gets hurt after Toronto finds a way to win game four. And then all of a sudden, it's like Philly just can't handle this combination again of basically everybody being between 6'7 and 6'9 and fast and athletic. And Harden looks like he doesn't want to be there at times. You know, Embiid's making the passive aggressive comments after the game about Doc Rivers should be the one talking. And it's all of these things are starting to build where game six is in Toronto, which is going to be rabid. And then all of a sudden you get in this. So it does. This to me seems like it's the most palatable potential comeback from a 3-0 deficit that I can remember, because usually there's a reason why teams get up 3-0 in the first place. And the team that they're up 3-0 on is not that good, or something is wrong with them, or they've got an injury. And in this case, so VanVleet is still out, but I am giving Toronto a real shot here. I think you probably bet on Philly in one of these two games, just hitting enough shots and, you know, Harden or Embiid getting going enough to get a win. But the intrigue is real. And I am not dismissing Darius, the first comeback in history. And it would be kind of fitting for some of the reasons Pete stated. What I didn't get to is that Embiid has kind of skated some on what's gone on there the last couple of years, but that's a whole nother topic.
There's always been a bigger scapegoat in Philly than Embiid. Embiid's an excellent player. He's a top five or six or seven player in the league. He'll probably finish either first or second in the MVP ballot. He's great. He also has potentially a torn thumb ligament in his shooting hand. And so, like, look, you hit a game winner, and then now suddenly your production is going to drop off because maybe you can't actually shoot as well, as your thumb is pretty important. Also, too, Mike, the point that you were making about Van Vliet is such, like, he is my type of dude. He is just a scrapper. He has fought for everything that he's gotten in this league, and now he's on a contract that he earned by being one of those dudes that's just going to give you everything he has. And Van Vliet isn't the classic small guard, particularly defensively, because he will hold up there. But offensively, he is a small guard. And the ability to challenge him on his shots, especially when he's banged up, it becomes easier. And so he's not been playing well offensively this series at all. And so you remove that part of things and you reallocate his possessions to, like, bigger wings who have an easier job of getting the types of shots that are more makeable. And then you have this game in Toronto, Mike, where Matisse Thybulle can't play, and he's their other best perimeter defender and one of their better athletes. And Pete, before the playoffs started and we talked about Philly, this goes back to what they were in the regular season even, one of the things that we talked about is, like, where are the athletes on this team? Right? They're more of a lumbering group. Yes. And one of the ways that they weren't that was, okay, well, we've got Thybulle, we've got Maxey, right? You've got Embiid. It's just like, oh, okay, well, when you don't have Thybulle, it's just like, okay, well, who are you replacing him with? Like, you're going back to Pete's old dude, Danny Green. Right now, Danny Green can be a capable player, but
he played 39 minutes.
He's not going to be a capable player at 39 minutes.
It's a big ask.
That's a giant ask for him.
Especially that was with Thybulle. That was with Thybulle available.
That's right. And that's to Mike's point about the rangy wings. That's an athletic deficit that a guy like Green is going to face within that. Is like you have to run and jump with a Scotty Barnes, with a Siakam, even on switches, on box outs, run the floor with them and all of that, D. So that is something that I do see this going back to seven at very least.
It's very tricky. And then, you know, look, the Glenn Rivers juju.
Yeah.
Right? Whether or not it's real or not, he's getting asked about it pregame. And he's going on the defensive about his postseason coaching record and honestly misremembering years of who won the championship and thinking that he lost to a title team when he didn't. Sorry, you didn't blow a 3-1 lead against the eventual champion Detroit Pistons. You blew a 3-1 lead to the Pistons that got swept in the conference finals. So sorry, Glenn, you missed out on that one. So when it comes right down to it, Mike, like, this is stuff that's sort of in the air there, and maybe people are starting to feel it a little bit.
So this is very anecdotal and just kind of me hearing things, and I would defer to some of the beat writers that have covered, you know, Rivers teams, but I think a couple of themes maybe. And so Doc can be really good at kind of the motivational speech and kind of like the rah-rah, like, let's all get going. And I think that sometimes, though, the problem is with that kind of motivation is if you do hit a rut or a wall or something, then you can't just go back to that motivational speech again, right? That's when the coach like Vogel, who isn't necessarily going to, you know, stand up like William Wallace up on a hill and like rally the Scots, you know, to go take out the English nobles, but is like, hey, guys, here's exactly how we're going to do it today. And again, it's not saying that Rivers doesn't do that either, but just those styles sometimes, I think, over the course of a series can make a difference. And so that's where I wonder, what does Philly sort of go to at this point? Like, what does he go in there and say? Meanwhile, like, Embiid's already annoyed with Harden. You know, they don't necessarily, like, Maxey has been great, but he's also kind of full, he's about, he's doing as much as he possibly can. And Toronto now knows what that is. So it's, that's why it's especially intriguing to me. And I agree with Pete. Like, I think we definitely go back to Philly for game seven, but it's more just like, hey, Embiid and Harden, go win this game for us. As opposed to this is how we want to attack and exploit this specific Raptors team, which is a weird team to play against.
One of the through lines of Doc Rivers teams that have collapsed, or even I even count them blowing a 3-2 lead against us in 2010. They were up 3-2 going into game six. I know it was on the road, but Doc Rivers will stick with what he does. He's like, this is what we do. This is our game plan against this team. And this is a longer conversation to be had. But one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the last 3 to 5 years, especially of the NBA, is there are so many more micro decisions that are happening. There's so many more, like one of the ways that Golden State, like there was a stretch of that game last night against Denver where it was like, Denver's pretty much getting whatever they want on offense because they're bullying or they're getting offensive rebounds, but they're scoring pretty much every play. And then Golden State switches to a 1-2-2 zone. And that's not something that used to happen, like these little changes of, oh, against this lineup, we're going to go to a zone or we're going to pick up full court. And there's much more of a diversity in coverages and like what we do, quote unquote, for any given team is not as narrow as it used to be. And this is in some ways one of my complaints about this year's Lakers team, right? Is that like we needed a zone look, you know, like yeah.
Real quick point about that game seven you just talked about in 2010 series, like, and I've said this before on this podcast, but them being forced to go to Rasheed Wallace at the five, like a space scoring five instead of Kendrick Perkins. That was a massive change that I actually thought helped Boston for the first half, even if, you know, their argument's going to be, yeah, but it eventually weakened us on the boards and inside. But like, to me, that was not a game where you would have really wanted Kendrick Perkins to the same extent as you would have wanted somebody like Red Riggs, like Sheed. And that never would have happened if Perkins was healthy.
100%. And that, And so that is very much Rivers' mentality toward these types of series. And so what ends up happening in a lot of those is they go up because they do have a good game plan to start out with, but the other team adjusts if they're capable and molds to what the other team or to what his team is doing. And then he's like, well, let's just do what we're doing, but do it better. And again, that motivational, that has its own like, upside and downside to it too. I see a guy like Willie Green or Mike Malone, I thought had his team very motivated. That's why they were able to fight Udoka. Like there are plenty of guys who I'm seeing that are capable of doing both. And so in terms of what I want our next coach to be, like we're the Lakers. We should have somebody who's capable of giving that speech and being able to sustain that fire, but also being able to make these micro adjustments, D, that we're seeing more and more throughout the NBA.
Yeah, the blend of tactics and motivation is super important. So there's two other games. We're not going to get into a bunch of the stuff around those games, but sounds like you both have Toronto winning to force a game seven. Of the other two games, do you see other game sevens on the horizon, or do you think that these are getting closed out?
Not for Dallas and Utah. I assume we agree there, Pete, but I think Pelicans have a chance to win a game six.
I think that's one thing I'm looking for tonight is I think that Phoenix solved the defensive puzzle on the Pelicans enough to where I think both of those series end tonight. Where are you at on that, D?
I'm skeptical on Utah being able to do anything, but we'll see. The closeout game is always super hard to win. We saw that with the Warriors. They struggled for a long time to close out that Denver team. The Pelicans game, I am giving the Pelicans a real puncher's chance. I like CJ as sort of a big game sort of player. I think that he's got some shot making in him. And I think BI is going to play better than he did before. It's probably going to come down to the margins again, like which one of these role players plays well, right? And if it's Bridges again, who shoots 75% from the field, and Cam Johnson, and those guys have pedigree and they were in the finals last year. And so you might expect them to actually do it. But if it's one of those games where Trey Murphy's like, yeah, guess what? I'm 5 for 8 from three. And Alvarado hits a couple of threes. And Valanciunas has a 20-point, 15-rebound game. Like, none of those things seem out of the question to me, right? And again, I mentioned this the last pod, but is this, do we start to see Chris Paul wear down? He looked worn down at the end of the last game. He looked like, thank goodness we won this game, right? And so if Alvarado matches Chris Paul, if Chris Paul has to play 35 plus minutes and in 25 of those, Alvarado is in the game and just being like, I'm picking you up full court, right?
Well, and it's Herb Jones too, right? Which is a completely different problem. You got this long rangy guy with motor as well. So you're dealing with something the entire game.
But I'm just saying, it's just like, even if you end up sort of alternating and finding ways to get Jones onto Paul in the half court, but having Alvarado just basically pressure his dribble as much as he can, right? Like, there are little tactics. You talked about the tactics just a minute ago. There are still little tactics that I see that could influence the direction of the game. And that's where I'm sort of at with the Pelicans. If the Suns win, no surprise. But I think the Pelicans have a real puncher's chance.
Agreed. And the only other thing I'd add, and maybe the difference between in all these series, like Toronto and New Orleans to me are more similar, and that they like they're about it right now. You can see in their eyes, though, they're excited to play these games. Mm-hmm. And Utah has not looked like that, right? They did rally a little bit in game four, but we've seen that for a while now. The chemistry and the mix just isn't there. Take the talent out, take the game plan, take the scheme. That stuff matters in game six and game seven, right? Your heart, your unity, and those, that to me is the difference in why the Pelicans and the Raptors, while inferior in talent, have a chance, and why I'd be surprised if Utah won, even though it's at home. And that would be the way I would define all that.
That's well said. There's a noticeable difference in juice between each of those teams. So this has been great. I've really loved talking about the entire NBA with you guys in these playoffs. Got that trio of game sixes tonight. We'll be back to cover that and maybe preview a little bit of the Boston and Bucks series in round two tomorrow. But until then, you've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound to Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel the winner. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Ready pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two. One.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable. For the victory.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five.
Bryant.
Yeah.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.